This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Liz and Michelle B. Thanks, guys. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the episode.
I mean, listen, I don't meet with any of the convicted murderers that are currently serving prison. I don't know that I would sit down and meet Curtis and then come away and be like, oh my goodness, I'd like this guy to move in next door to me and I'd like to do away with his conviction. That's never gonna happen.
I'm just beside myself with the unprofessionalism. I'm done. He's had his chance. He wants to offer Curtis second degree murder credit time served. Awesome. Anything else, f*** you.
A new limited series from A&E, Kids Behind Bars, investigates the sentencing and incarceration of juvenile offenders and uncovers a more complex problem than the network's customary blunt force series naming conventions might initially suggest. And the Looking for Mr. Goodbar story was definitely more complicated than the 1977 film might have suggested, and less reductively sexist, too. A Crime to Remember unpacked the murder of Roseanne Quinn, and Piper Weiss is back to unpack that, plus adolescent brain development, defensive documentarians, and who's going to play us in the reenactments on The Blotter Presents, episode 94. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. My guest is author and fellow whiskey connoisseur Piper Weiss. Welcome back, Piper.
So good to be here.
Who would play you in a reenactment?
Ooh, Gabby Hoffman, are you listening?
Ooh, that's a good one.
That'd be the dream, yeah.
Yeah, I am not sure who would play me. I think Angie Harmon, who is the only one with the correct height baritone combo. We really don't look alike at all, but you know, we do what we have to do. Speaking of which, what we have to do is get into our most wanted section. Today in the Most Wanted section, we are discussing a limited series from A&E called Kids Behind Bars. Here's the case file from A&E's page on the show. Kids Behind Bars, Life or Parole, tells the individual stories of eight previously convicted child offenders sentenced to mandatory life terms without parole, who are now seeking resentencing on the heels of a recent United States Supreme Court ruling. Sidebar, it's not that recent. It was like 2012. The wheels of justice barely grind. Anyway, continuing, while some may be resentenced to life, others could be immediately released or given a new sentence that makes them eligible for parole. This show is premiering next Tuesday, April 30th, but we got screeners. So there's like a whole like cluster bomb of true crime material going off on like May 2nd. So I'm trying to spread things out a little bit. But once again, that'll be on A&E next Tuesday, April 30th. Okay, so I was expecting something based on the title, like I said in the intro, I was expecting something a little more, like, there's nothing wrong with how A&E comes at true crime, but it can be a little, like, you know, jazzy, slick, wives with knivesy sometimes, and then based on the title, you're not sure what you're gonna get. It, like, their name, the show names are very broad.
I mean,
you're not expecting like necessarily a nuanced presentation of the issues here. Were you surprised at all by what
Oh, 100%. I had the exact same reaction. The title does such a disservice to the actual episode, which is really interesting and really nuanced, like you said. I was just like angry at some executive out there that, you know, had probably, like, I'm sure there were some other title possibilities that I imagine the network was just like, nope, Kids Behind Bars, that's going to perform well. And maybe it will. What do I know about, you know, network development and A&E's demographic. But this is actually a really, really interesting episode that it starts where you're like, oh, I don't like this. I don't like where this is going. And it ends up becoming a really interesting and important 40 minutes of television.
Yeah, I watched two screeners, and I thought it was interesting that, in the first case they're talking about, this was sort of a attempted carjacking by four kids, including the subject of this episode, Curtis. Curtis was 15 at the time, and I think they did a very good job laying out... they laid out the parameters of the crime, and they talked to law enforcement who was involved in the case, and they talked to various lawyers along the way. This happened long enough ago that Curtis is now in his early 40s.
Yeah, he's 41. Yeah.
And this was definitely... You have a bunch of different axes along which this was a problematic sentence. There's the fact that he was 15. There's the fact that he was and is African American. There's the fact that it was like a felony murder statute sentencing, meaning that he says he fired his gun in the air. Law enforcement didn't seem to feel that that was an inaccurate accounting of what happened, but because he was present and a man died, the automatic sentence is life without parole. He had just met these other kids. He had no serious priors compared to what they had. And the real crux of this show is looking at juvenile offenders, like mid to late teens, getting these draconian sentences, which may be deserved based on the crime, but can you necessarily assess what a 14 or 15 year old does compared to what a 24 or 25 year old does when we now have evidence that, you know, brain development is not completed for another 10 years after that?
And also there's the fact that two of the kids that were accomplices in this crime were white, and they were not given nearly as harsh a punishment.
Yeah. And one of them, they show a picture of him. His name is Michael, I believe. He's 13. He looked 30. Just this hulking child. Like, I was basically done growing at 13 also, but, I was not, done growing emotionally, certainly. This is a sort of a big basket of complex interlocking issues, starting with the fact that a lot of teenagers, myself included, can be / were little shitheads whose empathy for others is underdeveloped. And they raise that pretty early on in episode one. Here's a clip.
The four of them were transported to a jail. They were joking about this. They were having a good time about the fact that they had killed this guy, and even talked about how they'd shot him in the head above the left eye.
They were kind of heroes among their fellow inmates. I've thought about that probably for the last 24 years. They had no idea what they were facing or the gravity of what they had done.
Yeah, I should say that if you're planning to watch this show, visually it is not fucking around. It's grainy video, but it's still, they did shoot this man in the head. There was a ton of blood at the crime scene, and his hat is sort of knocked over in a snowbank, and there's blood everywhere. And there are some images that are going to be upsetting. So be aware of that A&E is not a network that is going to shy away from showing that stuff. But I think that this sequence was good at underlining that adolescents don't have perspective, the same perspective that we do, and that this kind of joking around about having just murdered somebody for functionally no reason, and then trying to take his car and not being able to start it, and then walking off through the snow and leaving blood, a blood trail. So not master criminals right here. But I thought that was an excellent illustration of just the completely different mode of thinking that you have when you're 15 years old or 13. And especially if you're, if it's a group of 13 or 15 year olds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This didn't seem like they had kind of recognized in any way the gravity of what they had done, or, yeah, understood what the implications would be.
Yeah, I think they may have been, Curtis possibly included, it was sort of hard to tell what various commentators thought his role was sort of in the aftermath. Mm-hmm. But there was this sense that they thought they were badasses. Like, one of them had stolen his father's guns, I think. Mm-hmm. And that it was all kind of a performative moment for them. And that this law enforcement officer, who is this like grizzled retired detective guy, is talking about this as something that has stayed with him for a quarter of a century is like, yikes. But at the same time, the show brings up the fact that at this point, like in the early to mid 90s, when even at the federal level, I think then President Clinton was trying to seem like he was more conservative than he actually was, at least in terms of crime and punishment, that there was this idea of the super predator in the culture that the media was more than happy to carry around. So let's hear clip three.
In the 90s, when Curtis was sentenced to life without parole, there were researchers who said that teenagers were super predators.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They're called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
And we're talking about a crisis in this country. Violent crimes, very violent crimes committed by juveniles.
Mandatory sentencing laws for adults were being applied to children. By the early 2000s, that research is all debunked. But we still have these sentences of people based on myths from the 90s that are just not true.
That was in fact Miss Hillary Clinton. Her pronunciation of super predators is, I mean, it's not funny, but it's, you know, sort of darkly amusing. I had not forgotten that this was a thing, but this was definitely a stalking horse, like here in New York City, and like it started with wilding and sort of this dog whistling way of talking about packs of teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think always meant packs of teenagers of color, that I had sort of forgotten that this super predator story or like myth was so prevalent, but this sequence, that clip brought it right back to me that this was the narrative about teenage offenders. And certainly nobody was talking about how, you know, nobody was talking about like the neurological or developmental timeline. It was just like, what excuses do we have to lock up kids, especially kids of color? But also, if these sentences are what we are going to use to tell ourselves that we're, quote, doing something about gangs and drugs, unquote, I mean, mm-hmm. it's dismaying. Like, the number of sort of public policy initiatives on the corrections level that were decided by suburban racists who were like, mm-hmm. I just don't want to think about this problem anymore. The solution is lock everyone up and throw away the key. That was a very effective move by the show to bring that up and kind of underline what we're dealing with here, which I think is almost always first and foremost an issue of racial bias and failure to understand societal, cause and effect. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm a sociologist, I'm just saying.
Completely. And then I think, the turn in the story is to actually hear Curtis's story of where he was at the time of this crime and, the years leading up to it. His childhood was the worst of the worst. He had really no one to raise him. His mother was an addict, and she was also so physically abusive that he was sent to the hospital with a concussion. And so he ended up being homeless, and he was homeless at the time that he met these kids.
Yeah. The way that the episodes are structured is interesting. This is the first episode, the Curtis episode. And this is a more straightforward question of, this man has been incarcerated for now more than half his life. It was a wrong place, wrong time issue. He was caught up with kids he had just met that day, and was tagged with the, felony murder stat sentencing guidelines that obliged the judge to give him life without parole. And has, I believe, been a model inmate. And now there is this Supreme Court decision. And much more evidence to suggest that younger offenders aren't responsible for their actions, but that they're not understanding what they're doing the way that we are three decades down the road. So this is a test case, I guess, for the show, because it's a little bit clearer, at least to this viewer, what needs to happen. In terms of, like, of course the victim's family is not trying to hear that Curtis should get parole, but it does seem like, given that the victim can't be brought back to life, that this makes the most sense in terms of if incarceration is even, if there's even a fig leaf of believing that it's about rehabilitation, then this is what needs to happen. Like, this man needs to be returned to regular society and try to take what he's learned as a grown-up out into the world. But the second episode it starts out being far less clear, and continues to be less clear. We'll get to it in a second, but I did want to play one more clip from the first episode in which Curtis's, I think this is his previous lawyer or his attorney from the time of the incident, versus his current attorney, who we heard up top being like, let him out or go fuck yourself. I'm not trying to hear from you. So this is, we start with his previous attorney, and then we hear how wonderfully race blind everyone is in Colorado law enforcement in clip 4.
Had a 13-year-old white kid, Michael Park, that couldn't be charged as an adult. He could only get 5 years as a juvenile. You have a 15-year-old white kid who is the only individual who receives a plea bargain and then receives clemency and is out at 20 years. And now you're telling me that Curtis Brooks, the black 15-year-old with less criminal history, less involvement, was not getting a plea bargain, was a cold, hard reality about the racial disparity that could not be ignored.
You can play your race card if you want, and that's fine. Let the court decide that. I didn't see race as a factor in this at all.
Are there places in the country where racial discrimination still permeates the pursuit of justice? I'm sure. Not here in Colorado and not in this jurisdiction.
You know, we're not Alabama is not good enough. Sorry.
Yeah. And when anyone uses race card, oh, it's just racist. That's, yeah, just like, oh, you're out. You're
yeah, exactly.
Not a card.
Yeah. Like the minute the phrase race card is uttered, it's like, well, that's actually you doing that. And it's not going to be a fair, you're going to be, you know, bottom dealing. So, yeah, I don't think that those guys came off the way they thought they came off.
Well,
but yeah, so the first episode, that's Curtis's case. And I won't give away the ending. I will say it does come down to a pardon or a grant of clemency from the governor of the state. And I will not spoil it. The second episode is about this kid, Aaron, who shot his neighbor in cold blood, according to law enforcement. And this is a much grayer portrayal of this kind of crime and the sentencing that follows on from it. This kid, initially the episode is content to portray him as one of the like dead-eyed little psychos that, like, they exist, but law enforcement, I think, generally wants us to think that they're far more frequently occurring in the population than they actually are, and that it's not possible for someone who is a little shithead at 14 to evolve into a thinking and compassionate person. That's just who you are, and there's no changing. There's no possibility for growth. Add to that that Aaron had a whole story about a black guy running away from the neighbor's trailer. Aaron and everyone else involved are Caucasian Americans. So they say very early on that he blamed it on a black guy, which is not how we do things, and that he had a fairly elaborate lie about what he said had happened. And was drawing, like, was mapping out the property for the cops. And they immediately knew that he was full of it and found blood on his sock tops that basically made it clear that he had done it. And he continued to sort of tweak his story so that it was, oh, we were screwing around with the gun and it went off. And there's footage of his interrogation in which he is like, the crying is so fake, and they show him at his trial and he just has no expression, and you're thinking, like, maybe this kid is one of the few kids that is actually a super predator. But this is where the show, I think, is really a Viking in terms of showing how complex it is, because even if he at 14 was a, well, psycho, can we still sentence him into his adulthood and assume that he'll never grow or change? And clip 5 talks a little bit about how those two issues are sort of fighting with each other, along with the feelings of the victim's family, who Well, you'll hear from the mom in clip 5.
You have to consider his status as a child. He was immature, not fully developed.
She got a life sentence. And there's no reversing it. So he gets a life sentence and it shouldn't be reversed because he's young.
I'm not saying every kid needs to go to prison the rest of their entire life. But there's some that do. Because I'm telling you, he's going to kill somebody again.
So that's fairly early on in the second episode. And then it comes out that if you think Curtis Brooks had a shitty childhood, Aaron's disgusting parents would like a word. They don't come out and say this, but the implication is that Aaron's mother, who is an addict, no judgment on that part, lent out her children, who were children, like young grade school, sort of gave them to pedophiles in exchange for drugs. All the judgment on that. And that he had moved in with his much older half-sister next door to the victim and her family, and had really been taken in by them. But there were some acting out and behavioral problems. He was not allowed to be in the house unless the parents were home. And this impending rejection caused him to lash out in the ultimate way. So this is a much more like murky, like the gray is a lot darker. And it also didn't happen that long ago. He's still only 22. But it was interesting that they chose to put that story second, and they led with the story that was sort of much clearer in terms of the implication that incarcerating like a 15-year-old is not doing what we needed to do. But the second episode, it's a little murkier. Did you get a chance to watch the second episode?
No, I didn't see the second episode. I didn't see it on the Dropbox. But well, now I want to watch it.
Yeah, it is there, and I recommend that you give it a look. No, not at all. But I think that's really smart because, you know, the parents and the families really are not sympathetic to the, you know, plight, I guess, of these now men. In terms of the fairness of the sentencing, because their feeling is like, we all were sentenced to a lifetime of grief because our loved one died. So they're not trying to hear anything from the perpetrators or whatever, alleged perpetrators, co-conspirators, whatever term you want to use. And I think that's sympathetic also, like the way that this show puts together all of these viewpoints and all of these different issues within the larger issue, and really isn't pushing much of an agenda, I don't think, except that we have to look at this issue, and B, we have to look at this issue in terms of like race. Because that's so often driving what's happening. I think it's quite good. It's quite compelling. It doesn't necessarily give you any answers, but I think I'm going to keep watching it despite the title that tells you both nothing and everything about what it's trying to do. Do you think you're going to keep watching this?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really interesting topic. I think that it's a story well told. And it seems like they're going to have a lot of different types of or kind of like a diverse array of stories that aren't always as clear cut. So yeah, I'm in. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, so am I. And I'm quite surprised to say that. I feel like A&E has kind of gone in this direction with its crime/sociology programming that is a little bit pat. You know, it's a network and a business, and they're trying to stay on brand and make money, and I get it. And I don't dislike Live PD, but this is interesting because they tend, I feel, to be a little bit more law enforcement focused or driven in their programming. Yeah. And this is much more judgy of the institutions. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that they're a little hit or miss. Like I thought they did Eric Tells All, right? The Menendez brother.
Yes, I believe series, so.
Which, again, a terrible name, but a really, really, I thought, strong crime doc series that was, you know, kind of, it had that Lorena kind of thing where they were, you were reexamining this case that you thought you knew in the 90s, and that there was so much more to it. And there was so much more nuance. And again, it really kind of tied into, you know, these young kids that were reacting to a lifestyle or the way they were raised that was not necessarily, you know, hospitable, and that there was kind
way
of
to put it.
I don't know how to put it, but yeah, I mean, it was actually a really great documentary, and so I do a lot of like searching through the minds of A&E to find more stories like that, and you kind of have to look beyond the titles to test out if they're actually going to be, you know, the kind of caliber that, say, Kids Behind Bars is. So yeah, I think they're mixing it up a little bit, but their titles kind of make it all feel very pat.
Yeah, and I shouldn't have compared it to Wives with Knives, which is an Investigation Discovery product, and even Investigation Discovery is like, that's not probably okay for us to name things that anymore. Although I think that is still on. I think that's part of their current schedule. But yeah, this is, I am curious to see if they bring forward a case in which it is fairly clear cut that this former kid, now adult, should probably remain locked up.
Yes, yes.
Because that doesn't seem to be where it's going, but I am here for it if they do it, because I think having a full range of these kinds of cases is the whole point of doing a series like this. So
how many episodes are there? Do you know?
There are 8.
Okay.
And I think they are doing a back to back with the first 2. But yeah, we will link to the show page in the show notes. And once again, that hits airwaves April 30th. That is next Tuesday on A&E. I have one more clip in which Aaron Schmidt's current attorney is talking about why this Supreme Court decision that is reshuffling the deck somewhat in terms of these sentences is important and relevant to the show.
Miller and Montgomery, the brain science that comes out of there is about the prefrontal cortex of children. This is the part of your brain that controls decision making. It's not fully developed till you're in your mid-20s. And when you're 14, it's nowhere near developed. So if someone can't control their decision making, should we be treated the same as an adult? I think not.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I could go on a like rant about this and like the selective service, driving, gun control, but and how many other things. If this is, you know, if this is legit science, then there are a bunch of changes that probably need to be made societally to reflect that. But certainly the place to start is here, I would say. We're not moving on to a much cheerier prospect, but I'm definitely interested in talking to you about A Crime to Remember, Season 3, Episode 2. This case, generally, the murder of Roseanne Quinn, was suggested by you, Piper. I'm going to give a quick case file, and then I want to talk to you about why you've been looking at this and your sort of other research and watching that you did before we watched A Crime to Remember. Here's the case file. Roseanne Quinn, a teacher at a school for the deaf in the Bronx, was stabbed to death in very early January 1973. The murder inspired Judith Rosner's 1975 bestseller, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, which in turn was made into a film in 1977, starring Diane Keaton. Quinn's alleged, quote, double life, i.e. enjoying one-night stands, some of which may have become violent, and the rumor that perhaps she enjoyed or solicited said violence, became a problematic trope that allowed law enforcement not to take sexual violence murders seriously if their victims weren't properly prudish, and to this day, quote, imperfect victims and their families can struggle to have their cases taken seriously. A Crime to Remember's third season episode, Last Night Stand, takes on the case and its repercussions and features not just former ADA and Robert Chambers prosecutor Linda Fairstein, but also the late Michelle McNamara, author of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, and the side-by-side photos of the real players and their reenactors recently decried by Emily Yoshida on Vulture.com, which got a very snitty response from one Joe Berlinger on Twitter. But I digress. I will get back to it because big boy boxers, Joe, come on. But getting back to the Roseanne Quinn case, you had been watching the Diane Keaton movie and thought that we should talk about this case. What had led you in that direction recently?
Oh, God. Well, I had read the book Looking for Mr. Goodbar by Judith Rosner when I was really young. It was just like one of those books that was like on the bookshelf forever. And
my mother too. And I think they were like horrified to find it in my room when I was like 11.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think I was like 11, too, because it was also just like this kind of like. It seemed like it was always this cautionary tale that my mother would kind of throw out there of just like, well, remember the Mr. Goodbar, which was, again, of just like at 11 being like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I had read the book and then I don't know. I've just fallen into a only watching movies from like 1977 hole. And so I was just like, let me watch this movie again. And it's on the full movie's on YouTube. If anyone wants to watch it, starring Diane Keaton and a young Richard Gere and Tom Berenger.
I forgot Gere was in that thing.
Oh, yes. He is so in that thing. It is really problematic. The book itself, I don't think is. I've started rereading it again, and it's a really interesting book. It's really well written. And what interested me in kind of the premise and then kind of like looking into Judith Rosner's work and rereading this book is that, you know, I think that what the movie got wrong that the book didn't is that, it's a story of kind of the sexual violence that kind of like permeates the male culture, at least it did at the time. And that's kind of like what the story around the thinly veiled true crime story is. It's about like this entitlement that men have, and that, you know, ultimately the woman is shamed for provoking their violence. So that really interested me. And then I became really interested in this idea that, so basically, the character in Mr. Goodbar is based on Roseanne Quinn, who was a teacher at a school for the deaf in New York City. And she lived on the Upper West Side and would go to these like bars across the street in her neighborhood. And it turns out, I did not know this, I am a born and raised New Yorker, but born after the early 70s, but there was this huge single scene at these bars on the Upper West Side. It was basically live Tinder. And so everyone was just going, and it was like a hookup spot. And, you know, the tabloids wrote about this as the way that the, you know, people wrote about Tinder a few years ago, of just like a hookup culture. Which
and this is all going on. This is all going on the Upper West Side, which, like, I was born a few months after all this happened. But the New York of that time is like recognizable, but not like if you were told that Needle Park was a real place, would you think it was on the Upper West? No. It's like, no. That's not, no. There's like delis. Yeah. And Woody Allen. I mean, okay, exactly. But, you know, that's a whole other crime story, I guess. Right. But
another episode.
But yeah, I was like, I had to look it up because Needle Park apparently was like a block and a half away from this bar, Tweeds. Which just looked like a little Irish pub, and she would go in there and like read a book and have a drink. Yeah. And there's this one scene where this guy who's like considered a suspect briefly, who may or may not have assaulted her during one of their assignations. And that may or may not have been at her request. Like, all of this was sort of in a like fog of rumor around her apartment building. But there's this one scene where they're reenacting this guy being like, well, you know, let me buy you a drink, pretty lady. What you reading? Da, da, da. And she's like, I'm good. And then he gets right in her space and she lets him buy her a drink. And it was like, this is a very familiar transaction, I think, to women, basically, that it's like, all right, fine. Like, let's just do this. So, and then I'll, you know, pretend that I have to be somewhere and leave. Like, I thought that was very effective. And actually, the whole episode's reenactments, I thought, were quite good. Which was surprising to me. Did you agree?
I don't agree. I really couldn't get through the episode. I was just like, what is this? I've never seen the show before. So I also, it took me a while to be like, so it's not, they're reenactments, but like you're in the story and it's like really acted, like, and then there's still like real people talking heads.
There was too many layers, definitely.
There was a lot of layers. I couldn't find myself in it. And I kind of was just like, I want to see footage of, you know, and photographs of the real people, or I want to see Diane Keaton, you know. I don't know. It was just
which they apparently could not get the rights to that. But here's, for the listeners, here's the setup, is that it plays out like your standard, you know, true crime show, which it is. But in this one, there's the talking heads present day, as we mentioned before. There's the reenactments, which comparatively, like, I watch a lot of this stuff, and I'm not saying that these were good or expensive. I'm saying that they were better and more expensive than what you usually get. Like, I was kind of shopping some of the furniture in the background, I'm not going to lie.
Oh, totally.
And the guy who plays her killer, who I think also played Dick Hickok in this same show a few years later, perfect casting for that, by the way. He's pretty good. But there's also this like framing device where instead of having like a narrator like Bill Curtis, for example, you have this character who is outside of, she's like in the story, but outside of the book and movie. She was like this neighbor of Roseanne Quinn's. And I'm not sure how this character, if she existed, figures into the other narratives, but she's definitely called on to both call out and also like underline this idea of the perfect victim. So here is the neighbor slash Virgil in clip 7.
Did the police take the story of one neighbor seriously and look at Roseanne differently after that? How should I know? But remember, the Good Bar story was about a woman who courted danger by picking up rough strangers in bars and bringing them back to her apartment. So maybe that's where the idea came from. Personally, I never heard anything coming from Roseanne's apartment. And on the rare occasion that she invited me inside, I got the impression that she might be a little too fragile for anything like that.
Okay, show, like, first of all, this is too many layers of, like, VO and narrative that are, and commentary that are happening. Like, take one thing off. And second of all, if you're going to call out the police for not, for sort of trivializing or thinking that Quinn asked for what happened to her, don't then put chips on another trope about, like, it doesn't matter what she seemed like or what her personality was. She was sexually assaulted and murdered, period.
Right.
Like, please stop trying to reframe her victimhood as acceptable or, like, grade it on a curve. Like, she was killed. Yeah. End of that part of the story. Ugh. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, like, a little bit off. It did not feel like the satisfying documentary about this that I wanted to see.
No. And I will say that in her talking heads, I think we hear from her in a later clip, but McNamara does seem kind of disgusted by the entire affair.
Oh, totally. She's awesome. Yeah. She is like the voice of reason in the entire thing.
Mm, for sure. So is that character that they like make up basically to walk us through? Like, again, it's a true crime show and you're in the third season. Like, I'm not sure we need quite this much handholding about the issues. Is that part of the narrative of either the book or the movie?
No, not at all. There's no character like that. There is a friend who lives near, who lives in the building, who like hears her cries a couple of times and tries to help her. But yeah, that is not.
And we see that person also, I think, but that's not our narrator.
No, it's very strange.
I mean, I found this actually, except that we had to watch it on the ID.com website, which puts like 8 minutes of commercials into every break. And you're just sitting there like, oh, now I have to pee. I thought it made some decent points about the coverage of this case and the, you know, perfect victim problem.
Yes.
And the way that the media would cover this kind of crime. Here's clip 8.
Media coverage of crimes of sexual violence was very tabloid.
There was an awful lot of opinions about, you know, her lifestyle, how she led it, what she did.
The New York Times wrote that the essential focus of concern in the case is the girl's lifestyle. In a sense, Captain McMahon said, a death like hers should be expected.
Even though a killer was still on the loose, the story was already morphing into some kind of morality tale about how a single woman who dares to have a sex life is really the one to blame when some lunatic kills her.
Now that I'm playing these clips, I get the feeling that this narrator was added because the production was trying to get certain soundbite quotations from the talking head interviewees, and they weren't quite getting what they needed.
That's possible.
Because certainly the woman we heard in the middle there before the narrator butted back in is an author whose last name is Gratz, and she is pretty salty about both the coverage of the case and, you know, societal attitudes about a woman who dared to have a sex life getting, suffering the ultimate punishment. We have one more clip from her, so I'm just going to play that real quick, and then we can discuss this, like, why the narrator exists, possibly.
What kind of sex she liked is irrelevant. The woman was murdered. So if you're going to tell me you think she asked for it, that's going to tell me more about you than it is about Roseanne.
I think people were terrified by what happened to Roseanne. I know I was. So they wanted to believe that she was a risk taker. Because if she brought it on herself, then it's a simple thing to avoid her mistakes. And you can rest easy at night, knowing that, unlike her, you'll be safe, right?
Oh my God, you're so right. It's like this VO girl, this like all-knowing witness, is the apologist for anyone who kind of agreed with the coverage at the time. I'm just like, I also feel like she was brought in to like soften, like there was like an overall note of like, it sounds too angry feministy.
Yeah.
Is there some way to soften it?
Like,
you know?
I, 1973 contemporary of Roseanne, just want to let you know that this was not an unusual way to like, I'm sure that's true. And this is an advised point that she makes. I think that a lot of that is true. I think a lot of shitty conclusions that we draw are derived from fear, but it doesn't make them correct, is A. And B, your girl Gratz just said the same thing.
Yeah, in like a better way, in a way that like feels more like relevant and like, yeah, of just like, and even just like the music underneath this woman's voice where it's just like soft, you know, it's like a washing machine commercial or something of just like linens hanging in the breeze.
I know, the fabric of our lives.
Yes.
Rent asunder by a rapist. Like, okay, Shelley, we got it.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, if I had been able to watch this unencumbered by actually the fairly telling ads for Gain and breast cancer medication and Pampers and single dose migraine blockers, yep, and all of these other lady products. If I had been able to just watch this straight through, it would have been more enjoyable. And I think for something like this, it's good without being, you know, actually good.
Right.
It is nice to look at, though. Like, the production values, they actually cared to make it 70s, and I enjoyed that.
The outfits, let's just be honest, the outfits are really good in this show.
Yeah, the outfits, the furniture. I do have some notes about realistic smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you couldn't find a single actor who smokes, really.
Right.
Yeah, because this guy playing John Wayne, what was his name? John Wayne
John
Wilson?
Wayne Wilson, yeah.
Oh, my God. There a single man who was named after John Wayne who
didn't
end up killing people?
I know.
There must have been.
I mean,
Not that I've ever
so
heard.
So far, it's 0-2.
Yeah, it's not. We're not doing well.
No.
With that, what this mostly made me want to do was dig into the case with the book.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, I definitely dug into the case with the book. And then there's also a lot of there's a lot of good archival stories and archival pictures online of how the case was covered at the time, the tabloid headlines, the police sketch of this guy. I mean, his story is actually kind of chilling and somewhat interesting and not really covered in the movie. It's just like this weird afterthought in the movie. You really don't get to know him as a character, but he was 25. He was basically like he had come to New York and had no money, had a pregnant wife in Florida or pregnant girlfriend in Florida. And he became a hustler, a street hustler. It's kind of got like a Midnight Cowboy vibe to it.
Which is something that A Crime to Remember makes explicit, that they're like, oh, so it's like a Midnight Cowboy kind of relationship. And then it's like, got it.
Right. And so there's kind of this underlying suggestion of that, you know, also, and it's actually really done well, pretty well done in the beginning of Judith Rossner's book, kind of the homophobia that is like kind of crept inside the mind of this guy, and you know, from the culture, and he's so afraid of becoming quote not a man, you know, and he's also actually I can't remember if the real guy was this in the book. He was a Vietnam vet with a history of violence. Wilson was actually, 23. He was a drifter. He had a history. He had like a minor rap sheet, and he wasn't allowed back in Florida, which is where his pregnant girlfriend was at the time. He went to this bar, this like singles bar on the Upper West Side, with Gary and met Roseanne, and they end up going home together, and he ends up kind of having it seems like a psychotic break when he isn't able to have an erection and ends up, you know, brutally killing her. And then he escapes and gets away for, I think, several days. He's just like going from state to state. Gary gives him money to get out of the state. And eventually he's captured, and he isn't in jail long before he commits suicide. Mm. So you actually really never know his full story. But they followed the case in the tabloids for, you know, as long. He was kind of like a front page guy for several weeks until his death.
Right. Well, yeah, I think I forget the exact timeline, but I believe that he was on suicide watch, but because overcrowding, which has just been, you know, endemic to the city's jails forever, and B, that I think he was considered a shit stirrer and was like, I think, filing a lot of complaints against prison guards who were not necessarily therefore diligent about making sure that he did not have access to instruments with which he might hang himself, which I believe is what he ended up doing.
Right.
And there's no mention in A Crime to Remember that he is a vet. And I think that there's probably a whole, you know, a whole novella about what he was dealing with psychologically on a number of different fronts.
it might have been, you know, I'm conflating it. This is what happens when you read a thinly veiled, like, true crime novel. I know the character in the book was, but now that I'm, like, frantically Googling, I can't tell if the actual John Wayne Wilson was. It is kind of alarming how thin the thin veiling of right. this crime is in Goodbar. I mean, it is like literally the exact same story, save for like a couple of details and two name changes.
Huh. Well, yeah, I guess that's what you get to do when the principals are no longer living. But is his name in the book like Don Lane?
Right.
Shilson? This was a somewhat enlightening episode that I don't exactly recommend. I think I would sooner tell listeners to read the book or watch the movie. Piper, is that where you are with this?
Absolutely. I mean, the movie is definitely problematic. Male director, there are some actually really interesting moments. It's a little bit experimental in the way that 70s movies are. Diane Keaton's incredible. Richard Gere is actually phenomenal in it. I thought he, or just sexy. I don't know. I can't tell the difference. But the book itself is actually, I think, the thing to read. I think that I'm now going deep diving into all of Judith Rossner's work, who, just side note, I read her Wikipedia page, and she's deeply inspiring for any writers out there. She was a struggling writer for years and years and years, couldn't even get an article published in a magazine, but just had books rejected, kept on writing, just because it was in her blood. And then she had Goodbar came out, and it was a hit, and she continued to write these really interesting books. One is about sisters that marry Siamese twins. One is about like this kind of troubled attachment problem between a mother and a daughter. You know, she's into kind of like dark female psychological stories. And so I'm kind of just a fan of her now.
Is she still with us?
She is not. She passed away in, I think, 2005. Yeah. But she put out a lot of work in her life, and it didn't seem like it was an easy, you know, foray, especially, you know, also to be like taken seriously as a female writer that was writing about women at that time, you know, and about, you know, a kind of thriller at that time, I think, you know, was probably, you know, could have been easily written off as just like that kind of version of like scandalous chick lit. And it's not that. She's actually a really excellent writer. So, yeah.
Nice. We will link to her Wikipedia page in the show notes. First, speaking of paperbacks, Piper, I think there's one that you might like to mention.
Say what? Yes.
Who, me?
Why, great segue. The paperback of You All Grow Up and Leave Me, the memoir that I wrote about an interlocking coming-of-age story about growing up in the 90s in Manhattan and a crime that happened with a child predator in my vicinity is out on paperback as of now, and it actually has a lost chapter that was not in the original version, as well as some cool little extra tidbits at the end of the book. So,
oh, nice!
Maybe buy it. Thank you.
I already have it in hardcover, but if there's extras, now I have to buy it.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much for coming back to talk about this stuff.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Stephanie Green on Aaron Lee Carr's documentary on Larry Nassar, and Jeb Lund on Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. Until then, if you have a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me, as I said, on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you could rate it on iTunes so that other listeners can find it. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you would keep that information to yourself. My guest has been Piper Weiss, who always laughs at that joke, and I really appreciate it. She's on Twitter at @ThePiperWeiss. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.